For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I am so excited that for 2024, Your Brand Amplified is proudly sponsored by one of my favorite platforms, Simplified. This AI-driven platform is a game changer for design and video content. With Simplified, I can effortlessly transform lengthy videos, such as my podcast, into engaging, shareable clips and streamline workflows with an intuitive subtitle generator. For designers out there, you can explore the AI-powered image generator, create compelling presentations, and design eye-catching YouTube thumbnails with ease. Revolutionize your creative process at simplified.com with a free trial. Now let's dive into today's guest.
Welcome to Your Brand Amplified, the podcast where we interview marketers, publicists, and brands to learn their stories, what makes them tick, and tips and tricks that make a difference.
It is such a delight to have somebody who's going to infuse some fun and lightheartedness into our discussion today. I have the privilege of having Alfie Noakes, which is Mal Barton's alter ego, on the show today. And you are a London-based comedy coach and promoter and have a lot of fun things to share with us today. So thank you, first and foremost, for taking the time out of your schedule.
Hey, no problem. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Yeah. So you have a background in filmmaking, documentaries, stand-up comedy, editing, all of these creative pursuits. How did that start? And how did your alter ego come about? I have lots of questions for you.
I can see that was three in a row quickly. I'll give you a very brief bio. I appeared on a TV show that was about movies when I was 19. And they liked me so much, they offered me a job being the T-boy. And then by the fifth series, I was one of the producer directors. So I carved a career that lasted 13 years in the media, and my niche was the cinema. I did the odd reality show and the like just to pay the bills. And then I left that industry. Actually went very badly wrong, 2008 banking crisis and all.
Oh, yeah.
And then as a brief hobby, a friend and I helped up, started running an open mic night. I'd always been a huge stand-up comedy fan, secretly hankered to give it a go, but didn't have the courage to do so. And then after running a night for several months, I finally had a go at standing myself in an open mic setting, and frankly did really well. It was an excellent first set, and very few people do well the first time. It's a steep learning curve. And then of course you know what karma does to you. My second set was the biggest car crash you could possibly imagine. Yeah. And my big ego took the pop. But shortly afterwards I had a go at the emceeing side of things, and I found my groove there really quickly. Back in my TV days, I was writing scripts for my presenters. I was often doing the interviews and then cutting them in to look like they'd done it all. So I brought my kind of TV production skills to the amateur open mic circuit, and then my shows took on a veneer of professionalism, arguably above most of the other nights. So that's kind of how I made the shift from one to the other, and then split with that guy and turned what was a gig once a fortnight, then once a week, ultimately to 6 gigs a week, booking 350 acts a month, introduced workshops, bringing in professionals to teach skills, and on and on and on. So that's a bit of the background, the shift from TV, film reporting to comedy. And then I believe your other question was about the name. My name, yeah. Alfie Noakes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is my stage name. I often think it's wise for, you know, my domain is mainly open mic comedy, not so much the professional circuit. Mm-hmm. So I do get many professionals coming in and headlining or working out new material in my room, but it's the broad bottom of the pyramid of comedy that I typically operate in. So often comedians get themselves into trouble because they might be saying kind of edgy jokes and the like, and in an era of Instagram and everybody recording their sets on their phones, I know one case of a BBC reporter who got into all sorts of trouble because he was telling jokes that were quote-unquote edgy to at least some minds, and some idiot in the room decided they didn't like it, recorded his set, sent it to his bosses, and he was almost suspended from his job. Certainly jobs in maybe arenas such as finance, social services, teachers, these are susceptible to kind of moral standards, and at the end of the day, people performing in their own time. So In certain terms, it makes sense to have a stage name so you can pass your real life from your stage life. And I recognised that right from the beginning. So, this is a very long answer, I'll get to the point. So, Alfie Noakes is in fact a sketch from the wonderful Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, the late great Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, who are also known as a sketch duo as Derek and Clive. And they had a sketch called Alfie Noakes.
Okay.
So, I took my stage name from that. However, it goes further. Alfie is my middle name. And 25 years ago, I was living in Thailand. And my first name being Mao, short for Malcolm. They can't say that the way it's pronounced. It comes out like Mao, Chairman Mao. Ooh. And suddenly, that's the Thai word for drunk.
Yeah.
So every time I met a new Thai person and I introduced myself, I'd say, hi, how are you doing? And it'd be the equivalent of saying, hi, how are you doing? I'm hammered, smashed, ruined, wrecked, drunk, whatever. And the Thai people just always fall on the floor laughing.
Yeah.
So my name didn't carry in that culture. So I went to my middle name and came back with a woman who was the mother of my child ultimately. And so I'd established the nickname Alfie and then took it that step further for a stage name. It's a very long answer for your first
question. I love it. I want these long answers. I like to go deep. And by the way, Saladika.
I mean, one of the things I teach comedians, you know, being a comedy coach is, you know, economy of words. You know, it's absolutely editing. It's as important as the writing. And every single word that doesn't serve an explicit purpose must come out in your redrafting process. So the fact that I've just taken however long it was to answer your first block of three questions, I'll try and take some of my own advice, Annika, as we go forward.
No need to, honestly. I mean, that's why I threw so many questions at you, because I wanted to get the real answers. We like to dig deep, so no worries. You're not using the filler words that people sometimes use. You're not doing the ums and the uhs, which I imagine, of course, is because you have so much experience speaking. And that's something that you've taught as well. And you're not just to comedians or people who might want to pursue stand-up, because I would imagine that there are people who want to pursue stand-up, but that's not the majority of people who would want to perform on open mic. A lot of times, open mic is about that person who has a closet dream. They have a day job. Maybe they don't want to take time and not have a steady income and all of the other things that you have to invest in to pursue that creatively as a full-time thing.
Yeah, I think there's something of a misunderstanding. In the open mic circuit, I'm obviously here in London. It's one of the healthiest open mic circuits, comedy circuits in the world. Mm-hmm. On any given night, you've got several choices of places to either go and watch or perform comedy. I've been asked the question recently, and I reckon it's probably fewer than 20% of people on the open mic circuit are really going from the point of view of trying to make it as a career.
Yeah.
And everybody else is some form of hobbyist, which some people get steery about. I think it's absolutely wonderful. You know, some people decide to play golf. Some people, you know, just go to the pub and drink. Well, this is a chance of going to the pub and having a drink all the same. But there'll be a load of people trying to make you laugh. You'll have a chance to make them laugh. And it's, you know, a community in a circuit of sorts. But quite clearly, so many of the skills of comedy are transferable into the real world, whether that's dating, trying to negotiate anything, whether it be a plumber or a promotion. And, you know, there's a whole slew of jobs in this world that involve public speaking of sorts, whether it's one-to-one or one-to-many. There's so many of the skills that a developed comedian has in their quiver, so to speak, can be applied in a broader world. And, you know, people like people who make them laugh. It's a social lubricant. So on that level alone, if you can make somebody laugh fairly soon after you've met them, chances are you're going to build just a slightly better bond than you might have done otherwise. And if you're speaking one-to-many, slightly different skill set. But if you can make a room of people chuckle or laugh, and then you're trying to deliver a very important point at a conference or whatever it might be on a professional basis, once again, it's something of a superpower.
Yeah, that is the perfect word for it, superpower. Because public speaking is something that people, number one, are so scared of. That every time you're speaking to anybody you don't know at the grocery or anywhere, it's public speaking. Right. But people always assume it's in front of a lot of people that I don't know and they're going to judge me. And a lot of people also don't necessarily find themselves funny or think about themselves, have the confidence to think about how they can turn something into something that's going to get people to think a little bit more because they're injecting humor.
So how do you help people learn the skill and feel comfortable and confident using that, you know, little bit of humor, that kernel inside them, whether it's deep, 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 or whether it's right at the surface, and become comfortable with presenting themselves and speaking? Because absolutely correct, this is such a transferable skill. And it's something that's so important for everybody's branding these days.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously many, many ways of approaching it. And it depends, as I say, whether it's a comedy club setting. I think you and I are now talking more, say, a professional setting. There are certain universal truths in comedy, and then you can the artistic flourishes as you see fit. But certainly surprise is a critical element of comedy. Giving somebody the impression that we're going over here and then dropping them over this way. However, there must be a logical truth. If the logic breaks down, it won't work. Demonstrating something that's truthful. You know, if you can point out what people recognize to be truthful, even better if it's a often unstated truth. But once you point it out, everybody has it, a kind of, yeah, that's right. I haven't quite noticed, but that is indeed the case. If you can identify something that is a common enemy, and that could be just something as such as a frustrating piece of software or a notorious figure in one's industry, and make a joke about that, and then you're acknowledging something that is shared experience. There's any number of ways of going into it. But yeah, if you can find an idea that you can mine, and the first starting point for any joke is finding your premise, the originating idea. What I'll very often teach will be the firsts and the worst. So if one just takes 2 or 3 minutes to write down a list of all of your first dates, first holiday without your parents, first job, first time you got fired, and then you go through your worst, the worst thing anybody ever said to you, the worst heartbreak you ever had, obviously time being the great healer, what would have been an awful story to show of somebody when you were 17 is probably quite amusing by the time you're 30. So to find those original ideas really doesn't take a whole lot of effort if you just focus on firsts and worsts. And then just go to sleep, just forget about it. And you'll find when you're brushing your teeth the next day, or, you know, you're on your way to work, having a coffee, whatever it is, the tendency is your subconscious will have done some degree of work. You can go, oh yeah, that was the original idea, but on top of that, what about this? And then I would suggest drafting it down. The first draft is always the worst draft. I don't know if I can swear on your show, but I'm going to anyway. Ernest Hemingway famously said, you know, the first draft of everything is shit. And that's entirely true. So a lot of people I've seen falter when they decide they're going to sit down, write some comedy. Well, it doesn't necessarily come by the clock. Just because you're free at 8 o'clock on Wednesday night and you said you were going to do it, it's not necessarily going to happen then. But if you just jot down those premises, your first, your worst, your ideas, in just 10 or 15 minutes, leave it and come back to it a couple of days later, and just do a little bit of editing, 2 or 3 of those 20 ideas will pop out in a way the others don't. So you've already focused in on 2 or 3 ideas that you can probably work with. I could go on for all of time about kind of editing down, use of plosive words, certainly economy of words. Every word should be useful. It should be conveying some specific information. Which is why a lot of jokes need testing and trying. It's most certainly a case of calibration. So a classic joke is, I'm sure you know, it's a setter and then a punchline. And the punchline often has that surprise in it. Okay. If you don't have enough information in that setter, then the punchline just can't make sense. So the joke can't work. If you have too much information, then the audience will guess what the punchline is. Thus, there's no surprise. Thus, it can't work. So very often, there's a great joke there, but it has to be told a handful of times, you know, A, B, C, and D tested, so to speak, to find out where the sweet spot is of not too much and not too little information.
Yeah.
I could go on with 100 different examples, but that might be some starting points for you.
That's fantastic. Is that how you all approach whether you're teaching people who are looking at being more comfortable speaking in corporate settings and also people who do want to become comedians? Because I know you've worked with both factions. Is it the same construct? Because it sounds a lot like when I talk about brand storytelling. Those are the things that you're saying are the hooks and the stories that we have in our own lives that we now could look at back at and think are find funny are very relatable to other people, right? And is that where the commonality and the community comes in?
And there are two different lanes, to be clear. So let's say there's comedy here, standard comedy here, and say corporate, for want of a better word, here.
Right.
And the agenda is somewhat different. Again, you've got to consider, is it one to many or one to one? Let's work on the idea it's one to many. if somebody's coming from a stand-up comedy point of view, bottom line is they want to get as many laughs a minute as they can. You know, if they're doing well in the open mic circuit, they should be getting 15 big laughs in 5 minutes. And a five-minute set, I speak rather quickly. I think you've probably gleaned by now, but the average person speaks at 3 words a second. So a five-minute set is about 900 words. But actually, it's nearer 850 because you want beats and pauses and just allowing, you know, the space. Okay, so about 850 words. So sometimes somebody will come to me wanting me to coach them and go, I've got 20 pages of notes. I'm like, right, come back to me when you've got two. Edit it down to the best two, and now we can focus on that. You know, quantity is not quality. So having a framework of what you need to achieve is really helpful. A five-minute set, you're looking at about 850 words. Ideally, three punches a minute or thereabouts. Maybe be clear. You could go a whole minute without a laugh, building up the tension and the story, and then have a punch and a tag and a tag, and that's three big laughs in a row. Okay. So there's a particular dynamic there, and then the five-minute spot open micer will be aiming for a 10, and then latterly a 20, and if they're getting all those laughs in a 20-minute spot, they're kind of knocking on the door of paid and pro gigs. So more on the corporate side, I'll take an agenda from whoever it is I'm working with. Let's say, for example, it's a head of a department who has to speak at a conference. They'll quite often give me the speech they have to give and tell me what the, you know, it's an audience of 800. It's going to be at this time of day. I'll be on after four of the speakers. They'll have spoken about X, Y, and Z. I want to know who's coming on after them, how tired they're likely to be, what's the approximate demographic of the audience. Obviously, I need to know what the title of their talk is.
Right.
And then I want them to give me their script, what they're going to say. And then what I'll do is really twofold. Again, I can teach DC stand-ups as well. It's more important to be fascinating than it is to be funny in the first instance. You could be an open mind comedian who really only raises, say, two laughs in your 5 minutes. But if what you're saying is fascinating and it's just really interesting anyway, the audience will be very forgiving. You've got a little bit more experience under your belt. Now you revisit it and try and insert more jokes. You build it up that way. Much better to do that than go all out to try and get lots of laughs. And as a newer act, maybe went out in coaching from somebody like me, or and they've just thrown themselves in the deep end, then the chances are those clear effort to get a laugh fail, well, that's bad for everybody, act and audience alike. So by being fascinating and building jokes on top is much better than trying to write jokes first and foremost, and then it may or may not be fascinating. So in the corporate world, it's very much the same thing. So let's say they're an accountant, okay? Generally considered to be not the most fascinating thing in the world.
Yeah.
So I'll read what they've written to get a sense of, okay, this is the message you want to give. First and foremost, let's see how much we can get this down. How many words can we lose? It's a 20-minute speech. Can we get it down to 60? Because you're waffling some. I've already helped them with paper then. Then the idea is maybe we can find a story. Maybe it's your origin story for how you got into this. Or we could go the other end. What would you ideally like the ultimate outcome to be? So now let's fantasize what that might look like. So you can find stories that you can weave into the core message you're always going to give in the first place, the original speech. And then after that, it's a redrafting process of putting in jokes. And very often a good way of finding a joke is asking yourself the question, what is that like? So if they're talking about a piece of accountancy software, well, if that was like a sports team, what parallels can you draw? What things are they sharing in common? So one thing I teach is called finding the overlap. Just take, because I'm a big fan of people avoiding the blank page and screen. It's a terrible thing, as I mentioned earlier, to say 8 o'clock Wednesday night, I'm going to sit down and write comedy. It doesn't necessarily come like that. What's better is if on Monday you took 5 minutes to write down your first, and then on Tuesday, 5 minutes to write down your worst, and then on Wednesday you sit down, and at that point you can start passing some things out. So finding out how to punch up their speech is a sense of getting something out of them. Where did they come from? What do they want to share with people? And then if they want to talk about a certain thing, find the parallel that this software is like this sports team that is notoriously bad, will always lose, or whatever it might be. And write a list of things to just bring to mind. It's like a word association, the name of the sports team and the name of the software, which is in this example. Just brain dump for 3 minutes on each of them. And then you will find somehow or other there's some overlap there, and then we're getting close to the structure of a joke. But they may speak for 2 minutes about a shot on goal of trying to be funny. They're just giving their standard speech. But then they can get into this 30-second bit where it's a clear attempt to highlight the points they're making whilst being funny. Then get back to your standard speech, and then we'll insert some funny. Yeah. So it's very often a redrafting process. First draft is always terrible. Second draft is somewhat better. Draft again, take out all those excess words. Draft again and find evocative wordle. You know, thesaurus.com is your friend. I've been a professional writer in some form or another for over 13 years now, and I use it routinely. So if the wording might be, I was walking down the road the other day and this man came to me and he said, okay, it's fine, it conveys the information. But if I said, I was bowling down the road the other day and this geezer came over to me and he yelled, well, that's a much more clear and a kind of exciting image.
Right.
I'd used exactly the same number of words. So just punching up your script or your speech with evocative wording is another way of just making it all the more captivating. I did keep on going, but certainly the way somebody would open their speech is all important. You want to establish something of who you are and hopefully get a winning joke at the top. Obviously, that's fraught with danger. If you take a shot on goal with a joke that doesn't land, it gets a bit tricky. So you've got to make sure that joke is good. And one of the golden rules of comedy, I think any professional comedian would agree, you typically open with your best joke and close with your second best joke, or vice versa. Because you want to open strong and you want to leave that kind of sweet taste in the mouth or the mind of the audience.
Yeah.
So even if you have only two jokes, top and tail them would be my advice. But it depends what tone, you know, the speaker wants to go for.
I really like the idea of using comedy instead of, because I think typically when you think of, and maybe this is a few years ago, but you think about people giving big speeches, and a lot of times people think about, what quote am I going to say at the beginning of my speech that everybody will know, that will connote the seriousness of what we're talking about, or whatever the case may be, or the message of hope that I want to bring. But I think comedy is a leveler, and it brings something a little bit different, a different kind of hook that can engage the audience in a different way rather than thinking, oh, this is going to be the same old rote speech. And one thing I heard you say is have a through line. So it's like the callback, right, to the initial joke. So don't just leave it, but make sure it's something you can reference, especially if it lands well, because then that creates those constructs in somebody's mind where they're really attaching to the important subject matter that you're trying to get across, but with a fun infused in it. So it's a different kind of hook to help them remember.
Yes, certainly. I mean, you mentioned that a callback, just for the clarity for your audience in case they don't know. A callback is a joke. It's a meta joke. It's a joke that references a joke or a point you made earlier. And for the record, audiences love them. There's an extra power. If you could mark jokes out of 10, you know, get a polite chuckle around the room, say that's 5 out of 10. If they're roaring in the aisles, that's 10. Tumbleweed is 0. So callbacks typically get maybe 2 more points than the joke actually deserves because the audience like them so much. And they're very good to, if you close your set, as I said, ideally with your first or second best joke, if you can also wrap that into being a callback, it gets even more. And the actual special beauty is it gives the illusion of structure, even if there was no structure at all.
Okay.
So it's a little cheat there.
Nice.
And then you mentioned through line. Yes, of course, people, again, speaking of the corporate side of things, and we're going to assume a public speaker at a conference. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay, so something like that. So once they've introduced themselves with a joke, a laugh of sorts, and then basically said, this is what I'm going to be talking about, they can pick a running theme. I gave the example already. It could be that they're contrasting their topic or their product or this individual with a sports team that is notoriously bad or equally notoriously good, depends what your association might be. The fact is, if it's a running theme, you can utilize both. You know, I'm an Englishman, I'm not overly familiar with your American sports team. I've heard of, you know, the Dallas Cowboys and the Denver Broncos, but I don't know much about them any more than I imagine you know much about West Ham United and Aston Villa in our soccer league.
But, no, I only know about Wrexham.
Oh, is that the Ryan Reynolds influence? Wow,
yeah.
That's absolutely incredible because, yeah, I won't get into it, but trust me, they're not a particularly famous team until it happened.
Right.
But if the speaker were to take the concept of sports teams as kind of metaphor and kind of reference points, it looks quite an open field, pardon the pun, where they can, you know, reference the winning team at the appropriate time and then throw a team losing team at the other. Of course, it could be fraught with danger, because if I were in that audience at an American conference, it's going to go over my head, because I don't know so much about American football. You know, I don't want to get into, you know, identity politics, but my assumption is males tend to be more attracted to watching American football, or we just call it football, than females. So that might divide the audience a little. So there should be some thoughtfulness as to how relatable the subject is going to be. Some themes will appeal to certain aspects of the audience more than others. You know, I was a film journalist, if I start referencing 90s movies and big stars of the day back then, like Kevin Costner, Mel Gibson, you know, people that I interviewed and stuff in the time, my teenage boy barely knows who they are, you know? And his celebrities, I don't know who they are, because they're YouTube stars and the like. So, you know, you have to be mindful that your reference points are known and well enough to your audience. But finding a running thing that they can connect to and then kind of riding some kind of glories to what they're known for and attaching it to your tale is one of the many ways.
It's like you're reading my mind, because that was exactly going to be my next question. Was, it's funny because I just was on a call this past week where we opened it up and people were waiting for everybody else to come into the Zoom for this round table, and people started talking about sports and particularly American football and all the games that are going on right now. And of course, there were people who couldn't relate. And so that I was like, what is the other thing that you could talk about that people would know about? And I guess here for American football, the music connection, people talk a lot about Taylor Swift and how now she's dating, you know, Jason Kelce or Travis Kelce. And that's their connection. So people know a little bit more, but they don't know necessarily anything about the teams and all of that. Then when you were just talking about the 90s, I just gave a workshop for Red Bull on branding. And I was listening to some of the students talk beforehand. They were talking about being born in 2000. And my slides open with when I was a club promoter in about that time frame. And so I'm showing all these pictures that, you know, they were not digital photos. I had to take a photograph of photos to put them
and scan an actual celluloid representation. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But just thinking, I'm like, you are all talking about being born in the 90s. And here's what I was doing in the 90s. It was funny. It wasn't a joke, but it was a funny reference point for them in terms of.
You've got to be more. I mean, I believe it or not, I had a period of 2 years where I was a nightclub reviewer. So I had to go to 30 nightclubs every month and made it the writer for the UK Club Guide. Yeah, to be honest, it just got a bit tiring after a while, but it was still a lot of fun. But yeah, finding your reference points, going more to say stand-up than a corporate side of thing here. There are certain kind of cultural tropes that everybody will recognize, say Star Wars, the Marvel movies, maybe Harry Potter, something like that. And the audience, you make a reference to, I don't know, the Hulk, Spider-Man, Voldemort, something, the audience will get it. But a way to improve that, and it's quite, again, it takes calibration. If you can find some reference point that actually everybody does know, but it's not blatantly obvious, and the audience, when you say it, they can not just enjoy the joke for what it is, but there's a small sense that goes on, because we're always dealing with the subconscious of the audience. I'm surprised I haven't made that point already, because it's fundamental. Every time we say something, whether the audience quite recognizes it or not, we're all having a community dialogue with ourselves. For example, you must have watched a movie and something didn't quite make sense, and you're like, well, that wouldn't happen like that. And all of a sudden, you're drawn out of the movie. Or conversely, say it's a horror film, you know, and the young teenagers are walking towards a spooky house, and you're going, oh, the killer's going to jump out from the attic. No, they'll be in a cupboard. And you're having this kind of dialogue going on. And when we're telling jokes, the audience are trying to get ahead of us, see if they can figure out the punchline and surprise them. So important. But if you can find a reference point that isn't blatantly obvious, not absolutely mass culture, the audience won't just enjoy the joke for itself, but they'll also subconsciously, psychologically give themselves a little pat on the head for going, and I mean that as well.
Got it, yeah.
So if you can find that extra sweet spot of expertise, something that's not screamingly obvious, you're operating at a higher level. But again, tends to take a little bit of calibration, or at least a very clear understanding of one's audience. And that will be easier in the corporate world, because presumably everybody's there in the same industry and therefore understand many of the same things. If you're in a comedy club, of course, that audience really is diverse from 18 to 17, from all sorts of different countries, ethnic backgrounds, you can imagine. So you can't necessarily, certainly in a city, a global city like London,
right,
you might necessarily expect a reference to a 1990s advertising campaign to work for everybody in the room. You've got to take that into account. But if you're at a dentist's conference and you've got a great joke about molars, then, you know, they're going to love it because that's their thing.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've had such a varied and vast career, going from the world of production to comedy, traveling and living in other countries for a while. Were you doing comedy when you were in Thailand?
No, not at all. I was kind of producing. I've been looked at on three separate occasions. The longest was in the early 2000s, so internet cafes was still a thing.
Yeah.
So my producer in London, I was a writer-director, but I had a producing partner. He would go out for the pitches and then call me and say, coming up to the, 50th anniversary of James Bond, I think that one was. It'll be that anniversary when the film comes out in November. So can you please spend 2 days writing up a pitch for him to take to the production companies, broadcasters?
Yeah.
So I would get London salary whilst living on a beach in Thailand and just popping into the internet cafe and making use of my laptop.
Nice.
And then latterly ended up DJing in a bar on a beach for a while my girlfriend taught yoga. That was before my comedy era. I started in comedy 14 years ago now.
Okay.
So prior to that, I managed to take my production career on the road because I'd be writing scripts and more.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. And what is next for Mal and Alfie? You have been teaching stand-up comedians or people who aspire to be stand-up comedians. You have worked with corporations before and corporate people. Is that something you're getting back into now? Or what do you see as your journey continuing?
Well, most recently, during the pandemic, of course, we couldn't run any shows. And ironically, I just launched a new company in December 2019. So by March 2020, it kind of went kaput. So while I couldn't be running shows or be on stage, I wrote and recorded 2 online courses for comedians, one for beginners and one teaching people to MC. That one's particularly good for general public speaking, which would be referring to. But it is framed from the stand-up comedy world. And then just last year, I did an advanced course, online course, and that takes filmmaking techniques to teach people comedy. Because principally, every comedian is their own producer, director, writer, leading role. They navigate things like makeup, wardrobe, marketing, and publicity. And then once they start getting successful, they're navigating competitions, critics, and agents. So I've got these 3 online courses, and I think I've pretty much got those where I want them to be. They're going very well. I'm starting to winnow down my one-to-one coaching because I'm getting way more demand from corporate bookings.
Mm-hmm.
So that business I had just before the pandemic was called the Humor Works, and the whole concept was me and a team of 4 were then to go into creative businesses and teach them ideas of ways to find premises. Just as I mentioned to you earlier, we've got obviously more than what I mentioned, showing them how to write up, how to be funnier, how to imbue themselves with confidence. That's a big problem for a lot of people. You mentioned it yourself, people are scared of public speaking. And there are some fairly simple measures we don't ever want to remove the nerves, because one of the things I would teach is it's only a small step. If this is nervous and anxious, only a small step in reframing to excitement.
Oh, yeah.
I've got various tactics to show people how to make that step. I think the day you're not somewhere between excited, anxious, nervous, or you go up, you probably don't care very much anymore. You know, it's not a great sign. That heart should be a little bit faster, but there are ways and means of making it a more pleasant experience.
Yeah. I love public speaking. And my favorite thing is, you know, give me 10 minutes, tell me what I'm going to speak about, put me in front of thousands of people, and I'll get up there and come up with something. But it doesn't matter, even if you prepared your speech or if you are giving it off the cuff, I feel like that energy, whether it's the nervousness or excitement or whatever it is, it helps propel you once you get on stage. It actually helps you create like a calmer presence, because then you're using that energy to share it with the audience.
Yeah, so I mean, to be clear, as we know, I wasn't a comedian, I was an MC, but I emceed well over 1,000 shows, and I produced something in the region of 2,000. I've staged about 30,000 spots for about 10,000 acts over the year. So I'd watched a lot of close and personal, but from the MC point of view, the reason it appealed to me is because I'm not writing material and having to memorize it and edit it. I'm much better at speaking extemporaneously off the cuff, doing crowd work, about my own colorful life stories. And over the years, you know, obviously I wasn't great in the beginning, but it only took me a dozen or so shows to become kind of competent, and 100 shows pretty good, and so on and so forth. Public speaking, there is so much opportunity to engage an audience, to be, as I say, one way or another, funny or fascinating, one-to-one, one-to-many. But there are so many tricks. That's certainly something that works for both sides. It's a greater understanding of body language, because it's the optimum way of reading people and then leading people. You know, if I'm, as an MC, I'm going to do some crowd work, I know who to speak to in the audience. If somebody's got their arms folded, their chin's down, and they're barely giving me eye contact, I am not going to say, hi, how are you doing? What's your name? Because they're not going to give me anything good. And I just made an audience member uncomfortable. And we should cherish our audiences. You know, there's a terrible misnomer in comedy, particularly in open mic comedy. The pros know better. The part of the job is to wince or mock an audience member and hammer them. No. We only do it if they're disrupting the show. And even then, we should give them a couple of warnings, you know. In the public speaking arena, there is no need of dealing with hecklers. That generally doesn't happen. But one can always tell the story of when somebody crossed you. Here's an important thing to bear in mind, I would say, is in any story you tell, because in that advanced course, as I mentioned, I took cinematic techniques of storytelling, you know. So as a comedian or a public speaker, you can talk about truly awful things if the occasion merits it. You know, let's imagine it's a medical conference and you're talking about a disease or a condition or something. But whatever it might be, one can never be the bad guy or woman in your own story. You may have to twist the story, even if it were true, to make oneself either the victim of it or a witness to it. But you can't be the bad person.
Got it.
So sometimes you've got to go through your story and tweak it slightly to make it a more flowing story, because if you do something too unpleasant, too obnoxious, you will lose the audience. So there are all these considerations as you're developing your character, your story, your narrative, whatever it might be. There are layers upon layers on this. So going back to your question from a couple of minutes ago, what's coming next? I pretty much finished with getting these online courses where I want them to be. We're very early in 2024, as you and I speak now, but I've just done two trainings for two businesses. One was a communications company and one's a whiskey brand. The whiskey brand is very high end, and most of the people serving their whiskey are in like 5-star hotels, dealing with maybe solo traveling business people. So they wanted their bar staff to know better how to build rapport with somebody when they're chatting at the bar. And that was absolutely fantastic. And also they're such high end bar people that they have created their own cocktails, their own cocktail competitions.
Wow.
And I didn't understand part of my brief until the day before they mentioned it in passing. And I'm like, you didn't tell me this, but they have to make their cocktail in front of an audience, and whilst making the cocktail, tell the story of where it comes from, who they are, and how it came about. Well, I can imagine there's ways of doing that very, very badly, but those guys will be doing it really well going forward, because I gave them some fundamental storytelling technique.
Nice.
Like from, you know, establishing a hook at the beginning to make sure they stick around to find out how that paid off. You know, I'm using more evocative language and other things that are available in powerful storytelling. I could go for hours, but I am mindful that there's only so much that I could convey in one conversation, you know?
I know. I mean, I feel like we've already gotten a little bit of a workshop here. So thank you for that, Alfie.
I like to be helpful.
Yeah. Well, where can people go to find out more about your courses and everything that you're doing? And if you are bringing back some open mics and people happen to be in London for vacation or holiday, you can go see.
We still run open mics. There's already two shows a week. Luke and Paul now run the shows on my behalf. I obviously keep an eye on it, but they're the MCs in-house now. But basically everything from the course and the coaching is all on the website, wearefunnyproject.com. And if I may, there's a free ebook on the 36-page ebook, which is laden with video links as well. So it's more than just an ebook. And that's called 8 Ways to Turbocharge Your Stand-Up Comedy.
Fantastic.
So whether you've never performed comedy, maybe you've just done a few and you're not sure, or you're maybe 2 or 3 years in, there's good stuff in there. Tips and advice and how to get better more quickly. Because I see far too many people struggle. You don't need courses to get good at comedy. You'll just take longer. And, you know, obviously it stings to leave the stage if you've not had a laugh, or you're trying to lean on a laugh. There's another idea I'd point out, public speaking comedian. You always want to lead on them laugh. If you leave that stage to utter in silence, ooh, that stings.
Mm.
So, you know, we want to make sure that these key elements are addressed. So, yeah, have a look at wearefunnyproject.com. There's a blog there with tons of articles and videos and interviews, all free and Brazil.
Fantastic. Well, Alfie, this has been a really fun conversation. I know that everybody will walk away with actionable tips to help them, whether it's with a comedy journey or become better public speakers in the world of corporate and entrepreneurship. And of course, we'll have the website in the show notes for everybody to get to be able to go to wearefunnyproject.com, look at your free ebook resources, videos, and all of the other things that you have. So thank you again for taking time out of your weekend to be on the show with me. And thank you to the audience for coming back and watching or listening to this episode of Your Brand Amplified. I'll be back again with another amazing expert in a few days to help make your life and business a little bit easier.
Want more? Check out amplifywithannika.com or follow me on socials at amplifywithannika.
As we close out today's episode, I want to thank Simplified again for making it possible. For all marketers and creators out there, Simplified is your ally in effortlessly crafting on-brand content with a design and video AI. Discover how AI can enhance your creative process at simplify.com. Start for free and elevate your content game. Thanks for listening, and here's to your next creative breakthrough.